So this is audio number two, and we'll be starting as soon as I read the first question. Step number one, are you stressing out? You say cortisol is the most complex and misunderstood hormone in your practice. What is cortisol and why is it so complicated?
Cortisol is your main stress hormone. I think about it like an alpha hormone, similar to an alpha male in that it just doesn't take no for an answer. It's very aggressive and it's something that's super helpful to get you out of a crisis, but the rest of the time when you're not in crisis, it often doesn't serve you well. Now, stress causes high cortisol, but in later stages of long-standing stress, cortisol can actually swing too high and too low and everything in between, sometimes within a matter of hours in the same day. So what that means is often you can't rely on just your lab tests. You have to go more based on your symptoms. The other problem that happens, which is a more advanced concept, which is the idea of hormone resistance. So we know that about 40 to 45% of Caucasians are at risk for having cortisol resistance through something called the short serotonin gene. And what that means is that the lab tests aren't always reliable. That's where you want to really understand what your symptoms are, which is yet another plug to go do the quiz so that you know the root cause of your symptoms. But here's the main point. If you are in a situation where stress is unmanaged, stress is managing you, your adrenal glands, which are where you make cortisol, as well as several other hormones and neurotransmitters involved in the stress response, such as epinephrine, also known as adrenaline, and norepinephrine. Those adrenals, those cute little adrenals on your kidneys and your mid-back, they're about the size of a pencil eraser, they can't keep up. And ultimately, it can lead to a point where cortisol levels become persistently low, which is the worst stage. That is a really advanced stage. Now, in conventional medicine, if you talk to a doctor who's been traditionally trained, often they don't believe this whole idea about cortisol. They say, you're either in failure, which is called Addison's disease, or you've got a severe high level of cortisol, which is called Cushing's syndrome. But what I find is that many women, in particular men too, but more women, are in between those two extremes. So it may be that you have symptoms of high cortisol, you may also have symptoms of low cortisol. And what I want to know is what's dominant? What do you have more symptoms of? And when you read my book, if you go to the questionnaires, you'll actually see more detail about how to separate those high cortisol symptoms from the low cortisol symptoms. We want to know, what do you have more symptoms of? What we want ultimately, optimally, is for you to get to the Goldilocks experience of getting your cortisol just right, not too high and not too low.
So you mentioned this just now. How do men and women differ when it comes to handling stress?
Yeah, there's a few differences. So men, when they feel stressed, tend to respond in that classic manner of fight or flight. Men are also more likely to lash out or withdraw. They use something called avoidance coping, such as going numb, using substances such as drugs or alcohol. They stonewall. Their response to stress is thought to be at the root of their poor health as well. And, you know, the original data that was collected on stress was done in the 1930s by a guy named Walter Cannon. He was a physician at Harvard, and he's the one who coined the term fight or flight. And he actually thought that the stress response that he found in men also applied to women. But the newer data shows that women respond differently. We've got a different reaction. And there's a team of people at UCLA who've really led this charge, and I mentioned them in the first audio as well. They are describing women as having a response called tend and befriend, tend and befriend. So women tend to seek out the company of others when under stress, while most men do not. Now, of course, there's exceptions. I'm making broad generalizations here. But you can see how this turns out, because what that means is that marriage tends to favor men more than women when it comes to health. We know that married men, for instance, have lower blood pressure at home versus at work. We know that when you have a heterosexual married couple with young children, the cortisol levels of women rise dramatically when they worry about work. And men's cortisol levels correlate not so much with other concerns as they do with women. The other part that I think is interesting, I learned this a couple of days ago from a really interesting therapist who does some work on helping women with melting their men's hearts. This is a guy named Randy Bennett, and he was telling me about how men have more gray matter in the brain than women. Women have more white matter. And as women, the white matter actually makes us feel more connected and social. So there's structural differences in men and women in terms of our brains, as well as how our body responds to stress. That whole HPA axis, which stands for the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. You don't need to know the details on that, but I can get more into it if you'd like.
So some stress is good for us. How do we know when we've gone over the edge and that how we're feeling isn't normal or healthy? I feel like everyone around me is stressed. It's hard to know what's not normal.
Excellent point. I mean, the idea is not that all stress is bad. The idea is that you want it in the Goldilocks position, if not too high, not too low. If you don't have any stress at all, you're more likely to be apathetic and not accomplish your tasks, not rock your mission. But if your cortisol is too high, you'll get to a place where it's hard to focus. You start to lose productivity and you get to something that we call in science hyper arousal. And I think the slang for that is being stressed out. And that means that your body's alarm system either never shuts off or it doesn't shut off sufficiently. There was a great study done by the American Psychological Association published in 2012, and it found that 3/4 of Americans claim they have an unhealthy amount of stress to bear. And when I talk to women who work with me online, I definitely find that this is the case. You know, when we ask people when they feel stressed and what they do when they feel stressed, what we found in the study was that about 40% overeat, 30% skip meals, 44% have trouble sleeping and lie awake at night. And we definitely know from these surveys that women experience higher levels of stress than men. So the idea here is not necessarily for me to give a blanket statement about what's normal when it comes to stress. It's really an individual decision. And the way to figure that out is to go back to the quiz. So if you evaluate yourself, if you score high on the cortisol symptoms in my quiz, then there's a good chance that you have unmanaged stress and we need to do something about that.
So what is happening in our bodies when we have high cortisol?
Great question. What's happening in our bodies when we have high cortisol? Well, I want to back up for a moment. You know, I'm making a lot of this simple. I'm oversimplifying for the sake of trying to accelerate your hormone cure. But we need to keep in mind that cortisol is not the only stress hormone, right? There's other hormones that are involved in the stress response. And I want to really focus on the solutions for you, but it's worthwhile to just spend a moment backing up and talking about some of this. The way that I think about high cortisol and how it causes problems in the body is I think about your brain, your nervous system. And if we make this also astonishingly easy, we can think about this as having an on button and an off button. The on button is your sympathetic nervous system. I know you've heard of that before. It's fight or flight. And the off button is actually your parasympathetic nervous system. I call that your rest and digest system. And the magic for you as you accelerate your hormone cure, the mastery comes from being able to balance your on and off button. So a little bit about that. What we know is with race car drivers, bear with me here for a moment. I love how Brené Brown talks about how stories are data with a soul. So I was working with a Vedic astrologer. I'm going to get totally Northern California on you on here for a moment. I was working with a Vedic astrologer and he said, you are designed to spread a message far and wide in the world, but as with many women that you're trying to help, you have an issue with the same problem that race car drivers have. race car drivers are distinguished not by pressing their pedal to the metal and going all out. They're distinguished by being really strategic about when to take a pit stop, when to hit the pause button, when to pull over when they're racing all those laps and get the tires changed, get the windshield clean. They're super careful about really designing it so that the team works together. They have just a minimal amount of time, and they're balancing basically the pedal to the metal, you know, kind of that really highly productive sympathetic nervous system piece with the repair that needs to happen. And they're doing it in a preventive way. They're not just waiting until the race car crashes or runs out of gas. They're figuring out, okay, I got to stop this upstream. So as we think about the nervous system and this on button and off button, I want you to really think about your off button. When do you turn off? Because it's essential. A lot of women that come to see me or work with me online, they are not so good at turning off that button. They never learned how to do it. You know, maybe their parents didn't model it very well, or they don't love yoga or meditation. Sitting on a cushion is the last thing that they want to be doing. And those people are often the ones who most need to find balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. So your mastery comes in learning how to hit that off button. For women who are hypervigilant, which is a defining problem of our modern lives as women, hypervigilance is what keeps you from sleeping restoratively at night. It's what keeps you constantly scanning your environment for the next crisis. And it's also what accelerates your aging process. It makes you have wrinkles before your time. It shortens your telomeres, as we've talked about. It accelerates the aging process. So we don't want that. So just to back up to, okay, what's the story? Tell me what it actually does when cortisol's high. Just give me the facts. Facts, ma'am. Here's the facts. Number one, it depletes you of the happy brain chemicals. So it makes you run out of serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, some of those brain chemicals that really keep you happy and engaged. Serotonin, as I've described, is one of those brain chemicals, neurotransmitters, that's responsible for three main things: mood, sleep, and appetite. Dopamine is responsible for pleasure and satisfaction. Norepinephrine helps you with, when it's in its Goldilocks position, it helps you with focus and mood and sleep. So all of these, you know, if you think about Venn diagrams, I don't know if you're like me and you think about Venn diagrams, I think about them all the time because I'm a total geek. And if you think about the Venn diagrams, these brain chemicals overlap, don't they? So that's one of the problems, number one. Number two is that when cortisol is chronically high, it's got a few jobs. One of the jobs that it has is that it raises your blood sugar. And I just want to dive into this for a brief moment. I had the supreme pleasure of talking to one of the men that I have a major crush on, a guy named Mark Hyman. Perhaps you've heard of him. I think he's so cute. He's like a little dorky. And we had a lot of fun together in an interview that we did last week. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about one of the things that he and I were talking about. And that was that really important connection between cortisol, blood sugar, and insulin. So let's just talk about that for a moment, because when cortisol's high, you're screwed when it comes to this particular relationship. So let's talk about that. Here's the deal. When you eat sugar, it raises your cortisol. When your blood sugar is out of balance, your cortisol goes up. When you're stressed, when you're chronically stressed, your cortisol goes up, and that makes your blood sugar go up. So you get into this really vicious cycle where these things feed each other. They're not just additive, they're synergistic. They're synergistic, like the sum is much bigger than the individual parts. And when you're talking about something negative, not so good for you. So I'm going to give you a little example that I heard from Mark Hyman last week. He was talking about how sometimes you'll go on a little binge, right? You'll start eating foods that you know aren't good. Maybe you're having donuts or eating processed food. You go back to eating cereal, whatever it is, bread. And what happens is that you get these spikes in your blood sugar. Your blood sugar goes up really high and then it drops really steeply. And that leads to these spikes and swings. When you have that in your blood sugar, your body actually thinks that you're in a life-threatening emergency. And so it tells your adrenal glands to make more adrenaline and make more cortisol. Cortisol is like the long-acting adrenaline. Now, this allows you to release more sugar that's stored in your liver and your muscles. And that the problem is, though, that it raises your blood sugar even further. So it does this when you're on the low side with your blood sugar, when you're hypoglycemic. And I used to have this problem in my 30s where I would just feel all of a sudden, if I forgot to eat, I would feel irritable and angry. And my husband would just look at me and kind of give me those eyes like, do you need some almonds? So that's what's going on. You have these, when you have a problem with cortisol, you get into this pattern where you're spiking too much with your blood sugar, and that then is creating your cortisol to be even higher and more of a problem. So this is basically the idea behind the stress response and how it's connected to the sugar response, the blood sugar response. And as you might imagine, the opposite is also true. So when you're more stressed, when you're not managing stress skillfully, when you kind of feel like a tiger is always chasing after you. In my 30s, I always felt like, oh my gosh, did I get the field trip form in? I'd wake up in the middle of the night. Did I do this? Did I do that? Did I do this? You know, school lunches would make me raise my blood sugar and my cortisol level. But when you're in that place where you're stressed, you make more cortisol. And when you make more cortisol, it raises your blood sugar. Then you become more insulin resistant. You pump out more insulin. Insulin's a fat storage hormone, so then you start storing fat. We definitely know that people who are chronically stressed with high cortisol have more belly fat. They also tend to lose their muscle. They have smaller brains. I don't want you to have a smaller brain. In fact, we know that people with high cortisol start to fry their hippocampus. I mentioned this before. It's that part of the brain where you do memory consolidation, and you also do emotional regulation. You need that hippocampus. Take good care of it. So what else happens? There's a long list. Multiple sclerosis, increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, et cetera, et cetera. I've got this list in my book, so you can also consult a table that I have where I describe this in great detail. But another part that's important here as we think about high cortisol, we're not talking only about high cortisol, because some folks start off with high cortisol, and if they don't address this, if they don't turn the ship around, they start to develop swings in their cortisol. So it can be high and low within the same day. Ultimately, some people have low cortisol, and that's not good either. But I think as we consider how we adapt to stress, it might be worthwhile just to mention one of the guys that I follow, Robert Sapolsky. I'm a big fan of Robert Sapolsky. And he's done some really interesting work talking about how to manage stress. And I like him because he's funny. He's a little funny looking, honestly. He's a Stanford professor. He's got this big beard. He almost looks like he's from a different era. Anyway, he talks about something called allostasis. Allostasis. Allostasis is the process of achieving stability through how you eat, move, think, and supplement. It's by adjusting your reaction to stress, your perception of stress, kind of the gap between your stimulus and your response, as Viktor Frankl put it. It's almost a paradox. There's a paper by Sterling and Iyer from 1988 where they talk about how your greatest success with remaining stable is by being variable. Isn't that kind of interesting? So the idea here is, how adaptive are you? How adaptive? If you're not adaptive, you're much more likely to have high cortisol. So part of what we're doing as we accelerate your hormone cure is to really focus on, okay, how do you become more supple? How do you dance with stress in a different way? Especially if that's just the last thing on your mind and you don't want to be given a list of 10 things that you need to do. Now, for those of you who do have the bandwidth to measure some of these things, what I like to do when I think about your response to stress and how do you stay in that good relationship, good neighborhood with stress and not get into the bad neighborhood, I think about the different ways that we can measure these issues for you. I think about some of the metrics that we have to measure something called allostatic load. Allostatic load is this concept that's worth describing for a moment, and it's the balance of wear and tear in your body. And cortisol is a wear and tear hormone versus the growth and repair, the good neighborhood. So it's a balance between the bad neighborhood and the good neighborhood as you respond to stress. And what happens with many of us, what I see in my practice, about 80% of the time, if not more, is allostatic overload. So I want you to get honest about whether you have allostatic overload. In fact, you may even want to pause the audio right now and just consider this. You know, just breathe for 5 deep belly breaths and really be honest about whether you have allostatic overload. Is that at the root of the problems that you have right now with your hormones? Is that at the root of why you bought this program, why it called to you? So how do you measure this? I'm going to give you a couple of suggestions here. One is that you can measure cortisol in your blood. And I often will recommend this because it's the language of conventional physicians, clinicians who work in traditional medicine. And of course, it's not just physicians, nurse practitioners. There's lots of others who believe in this. And I find that starting with blood levels is a really good screening test. It's a way to look at allostatic load. Another way to look at allostatic load is the questionnaire that I've shared with you. I'm going to give you another URL for that. Here's another URL. It is thehormonecurebook.com/quiz. thehormonecurebook.com/quiz. Another way of looking at the wear and tear hormones versus growth and repair is a lab that I like a lot called Genova Diagnostics. And they have a lab test called the Complete Hormones Test. And I really like it because it measures all of the sex hormones that you make. It measures your cortisol and its whole family. It measures your progesterone. It looks at your estrogen metabolism. It looks at your androgens, DHEA, testosterone, etc. And it looks at the balance as a whole of all of these different entities. And you can actually create a ratio of the anabolic hormones, the growth and repair, versus the catabolic hormones, the wear and tear. So if you want to go further, great, this is an option for you, extra credit. If this is making your eyes cross, then forget it. You can just move on to the next little section. I want to mention a couple of other ways of looking at allostatic load. You've heard me talk about telomeres, and that's certainly a great way to look at whether you're overloaded in terms of your allostasis. And then finally, cytokines, C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E-S. These are the little messengers of inflammation. They're the little messengers of the bad neighborhood. And once you start to get too many of them, there's a problem. It's a sign that you are creating a bad neighborhood. And the whole thing with cytokines, it's interesting. You know, when I look at the a la carte menu of all the different ways that you can manage your cortisol and manage your stress, we know, for instance, that yoga was just shown to help people with inflammation. It's been shown to reduce one cytokine in particular called IL-6. Now, that may not mean anything at all to you, but if you follow these things in inflammation, that might be helpful.
So what is our HPA, and more importantly, how can we calm it down?
HPA. So this is one of those science-y moments. Let me try to make this as painless as possible. Your HPA is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Short version, it's the way that your brain talks to your adrenal glands. And your adrenal glands are this, you know, it's this really important endocrine gland that's in your mid-back that makes many of the sex hormones that we're talking about. It doesn't make thyroid because that's made in your neck. but it makes these other hormones. It makes cortisol and progesterone and DHEA and testosterone. So what is it? I think about it as almost like a GPS system. It's the GPS system for your body and how it rolls with the punches, how you cope with stress. And if you're really good at dancing with stress, at managing stress, then you have a happy GPS, you have a happy HPA. Now, what happens if you don't is that if you're chronically exposed to stress and you're reactive, you're in that allostatic overload that we were talking about, then you get to a situation where cortisol is so busy flooding your bloodstream that you cannot calm down the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. It's kind of like that scene in Fantasia where Mickey is busy with the broomsticks and it starts to get really trippy because all the broomsticks are like trying to move around. And anyway, I actually thought Fantasia was a little weird, but you get the idea. What we want is we want to make sure that we've got these really nice feedback loops and we're able to hit that pause button, hit the off button with your nervous system. That's the whole idea. That's the main takeaway.
So why does high cortisol make us age faster?
High cortisol. Okay, we've said this in maybe a couple of different ways, and I just want to maybe group it together slightly differently. When you're accelerating the aging process, part of what's going on is that you're in that allostatic overload. In other words, you are just pushing those cute little adrenal glands too hard. You have a persistently elevated cortisol level, and it's not good for you. So just to think about an analogy, who do you think ages faster? A woman who runs marathons, or a woman who is a monk? Can a woman be a monk? Well, if you just, okay, let's think about a man for a moment. Think about a marathon runner who's a guy, and think about the Dalai Lama or a Tibetan monk. Who do you think ages faster? So if you guessed the marathon runner, you're absolutely right. The marathon runner has much higher cortisol levels from running and is much more likely to get more injuries and ages faster. In fact, we know from some of the studies that have been done, the Helsinki study, for instance, that if you look at a group of men and you divide them into three different groups based on the amount of exercise that they get, and the three different groups are those who sit too much, the sedentary types. Second group is those who do moderate exercise. And then the third group is the serious hardcore athletes, you know, people who do things like ultra marathons. What we know is that it's the middle group with the moderate exercise that has the best telomeres. So here's another place where we can measure how fast you're aging. And we know that moderate exercise is better than the hardcore ultra marathoner who is making too much cortisol. Now, not only that, what we know is that when you have prolonged high cortisol, you get this domino effect. And the other hormones that are working together with cortisol start to fall into neglect, and it's not pretty. So your skin starts to sag because you're eating up the collagen in your skin with the high cortisol. Then your muscles start to droop because you lower your anabolic hormones, your testosterone. You need testosterone. It's really important for you. When testosterone starts to drop, especially in women, also in men, you lose confidence and agency and resilience. And at that point, your life and your body just aren't as lively as they used to be.
What are your three best strategies for lowering cortisol?
Well, I have about 97, and you've probably heard me talk about a few, but for me personally, I really find that yoga is one of my favorite ways of doing this. I am someone who is kinesthetic. I need to be moving. I can't just sit on a cushion and meditate. We know that that actually lowers your cortisol. Hooray for that. So if you're into mindfulness or you like to sit on a cushion, please go to it. It's going to help you lower your cortisol. We know that chanting does this too. So if you're more of a singer or you like to chant and say, oh, you know, that works too. I also really love something called GPS for the soul. And let me just tell you a little bit about this. You've probably heard me talk about this before. There's a group called the Heart Math Institute in the Santa Cruz Mountains, not far from where I live in the Berkeley Hills. And they just put out this free app called GPS for the soul. And they're just recently coming out with a new version of this called Inner Balance. And the idea is that you can use your iPhone, you can download this app, and you can put your finger over that camera and you can measure something called your heart rate variability, which is your stress response. So you can detect with this app how stressed you are. What is your allostatic load? Are you in allostasis or are you a complete stress case? The other thing that I like to do, because you know I love to talk about how to eat, move, think, and supplement, I really love fish oil. So fish oil is another one that's important. We know that somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 milligrams a day is very helpful for both men and women at lowering cortisol. Also, bonus prize, it improves your lean body mass. One other supplement that I like is called phosphatidylserine. Phosphatidylserine, everyone always asks me to spell this because it's hard to spell. The good news is with Google, you can stick it in your Google and you can actually find it even if you can't spell it. So it's phosphatidylserine. Call it PS for short.
What is happening to our bodies when we have low cortisol?
Low cortisol is really interesting. You know, I consider it to be kind of a later stage problem linked to unmanaged stress. And it may be that it sounds counterintuitive, but when you have gone through a period of too much stress, you've got more on your plate than you can manage, and you're churning, that's the period of time where you've got high cortisol. And then what happens next is that you can have both high cortisol and low cortisol within the same day. And then as your cute little adrenal glands are no longer able to produce the cortisol that you need throughout your entire day, that's where you start to burn out. That's where you can have high and low within the same day. You can also have the ultimate low cortisol. And that's not good. We don't want that totally flat curve. What happens when you have low cortisol? Well, this is the situation where you have irritability, burnout, depression, low blood pressure. You may have heard me say this before. I often will have people come see me and they'll be really proud of their low blood pressure, but you don't want to have low blood pressure. You want it to be in that Goldilocks position of not too high, not too low. Many of these folks, especially those who have adrenal insufficiency, also known as Addison's disease. In fact, I just saw a woman today who has it. She's 62 years old. She has something called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and she needs to take cortisol prescribed by an endocrinologist just to be able to make it through her day because it's a life-threatening emergency if you're really low. So orthostatic hypotension is another problem, and that's where your blood pressure drops when you stand up and you feel lightheaded. Another feature that we see from the literature is folks who are low in cortisol feel pessimistic. They feel out of sorts, out of sync with maybe the natural rhythm that they once had. They don't feel at home in their bodies anymore. And that's tragic. We must do something about that.
Why do we sometimes have low and high cortisol in the same day?
Well, we addressed this in the last question. I really think that when you're under chronic stress and you're not managing your dashboard, you're not managing that allostatic load and feeling supple and adaptive, the high cortisol can start to convert into a burnout situation where the cells in your adrenal glands just can't keep up. And that's where it's really common to be high, like I was in the morning, and then low in the afternoon, or the reverse. I had a woman that I saw today, 57 years old, and her situation is that she's got really low cortisol in the morning, and she must have a cup of coffee. Do not stand between her and her cup of coffee. And then she's got cortisol that's really high at night, and this started when she hit menopause. So the high cortisol at night is a problem because it's very hard to wind down. And she, as you might imagine, has had problems with her sleep ever since this happened. So there's many ways to deal with this, but I think it's important to realize that your cortisol changes over the course of the day, and we want to know what's normal given the hour of the day. We know based on normal circadian rhythms, if you're really in sync with the light-dark cycles and you've got the right amount of cortisol and melatonin, then you're more likely to be creating a good neighborhood in your body. A bad neighborhood is when you're out of sync with normal circadian rhythms.
What are the primary causes of low cortisol?
Primary causes. Okay, well, I just mentioned one of them. I saw a woman, 62 years old, with adrenal insufficiency. Rare. We see this infrequently. You know, there's a number of problems that just make you less likely to make cortisol. Addison's disease is one of these, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, also known as CAH. These are some of the main reasons why people have problems with low cortisol. Now, you don't really need to know about this. They're very rare, like 1 in 250,000 people have this. Another problem that happens is some of the people who have low thyroid function, or maybe their pituitary doesn't work. They have a sluggish pituitary in their brain, which is where you make the hormones that are talking to your adrenal glands and talking to your thyroid. You may be low across the board with your hormones. So those are some of the common reasons. Another one that's important to know about is trauma. Trauma. So trauma, for instance, folks who are traumatized when they're children. I have a colleague, for instance, who was sold by her mother into sex trafficking when she was a girl, a young girl. And she went through extraordinary periods of trauma. And one of the risks when you go through trauma like that is you can have post-traumatic stress disorder. You can have low levels of cortisol. And this brings up, you know, almost a chicken and egg phenomenon. What are some of the consequences of having low cortisol? Well, I mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder. Another is chronic fatigue syndrome. Fibromyalgia, all of these are really well documented. You know, conventional physicians often will say, we don't believe that there's anything that exists between the two extremes of Addison's disease and Cushing's syndrome, which is the high cortisol. But the truth is, we've actually got really good literature connecting these consequences of low cortisol to fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, electrolyte problems, bone loss, and burnout.
How does pregnenolone fit into the mix then?
Pregnenolone. So you say pregnenolone, I say pregnenolone. It all works. It's the hormone. It's the mother hormone that you make in your adrenal glands, and it's what's made out of cholesterol. So this is one of the reasons why you want to be careful about statins. You want to be careful about what you're doing with your cholesterol. I actually think we need to get a lot smarter about heart disease and not focus on the wrong thing. I'm not saying you must come off of your statins. You got to talk to your doctor before you make any medical changes. This is not medical advice that we're doing here in Fast Track Your Hormone Cure. But pregnenolone is interesting. It's one of these hormones that I find European women pay a lot more attention to than American women. Maybe it's one of the reasons why they're doing a little better than we are and they're happier. But pregnenolone is the precursor that gets made into all the other sex hormones. And if you are low in pregnenolone, it causes memory issues. It makes you less interested in socializing. You know, if you're someone, I had a client who came and saw me this week, who's a 52-year-old woman, and she told me, you know, pretty much every time she's got people over to her house, like she has a dinner party, she just can't wait to kick them out of the house. I mean, she loves connecting with them, but she has this feeling like she can't wait for them to leave so that she can extricate herself from the situation and go to bed. And I often find that that's something that I see in women that are low in pregnenolone. It also can make you have muscle and joint aches. It can feel like your life is not quite in technicolor the way that maybe it was 10 or 20 years ago. It can also be linked to PMS, although that's not as well defined as some of these other things that we're talking about.
You say the first step in treating both high and low cortisol is to make lifestyle choices that mitigate stress in your life. Beyond that, what do you recommend for those with high cortisol?
Well, this is where we're starting into the Gottfried protocol. So step one of the Gottfried protocol is that we're focused on, number one, the lifestyle tweaks. How do we eat, move, think, and supplement so that you really are able to have a more adaptive response to stress and cortisol is back in that neutralized position? So some of the lifestyle things, here's some good news. Dark chocolate actually helps you if you have high cortisol. It lowers your cortisol. You heard me just talk about fish oil and phosphatidylserine. You want to be careful about caffeine. So I find that most people who are reaching for caffeine are reaching for it for the wrong reason. You don't want to be having 3 cups of coffee every day just as a way of trying to have the energy to make it through hour after hour. It's almost like a high interest loan, and you're going to have to pay it back sometime soon. I'd much rather that you have a green smoothie in the morning with those beautiful antioxidants. Stick some kale that you keep frozen in your freezer into a Vitamix with the smoothie, a protein powder. And when you have that in the morning, maybe with a little maca, it's much more energizing and it's not a high interest loan. We know that acupuncture is effective. You've heard me talk about heart math. Orgasm is one of my favorite ways of managing cortisol. You can practice forgiveness. There's really interesting research coming out of Stanford with a guy named Fred Luskin, who's shown that when you do a specific forgiveness ritual, it actually helps you lower your cortisol. And not surprisingly, it also helps with longevity. Vitamin B5, vitamin C, these all help. I love theanine. Theanine is an amino acid that is not sedating, but it really helps you calm down. It's got an extract from green tea in it, but it's not got caffeine in it. And then step two of the Gottfried protocol, if you're not able to, you know, become more supple just with those changes, what I suggest then is to look at some of the herbal therapies that are effective, such as rhodiola. You have to be careful with rhodiola because in some people it can be overly stimulating, but try it. Some people really find that it's a lifesaver. It probably depends on your genetics and we're just not smart enough about that. Another supplement that I like is something called Relora, which is a mix of philodendron and magnolia, kind of this herbal combination that helps with lowering cortisol at night, especially if you're overweight. The ginsengs are also effective. And then the third part of the Gottfried protocol is to consider bioidentical hormones. But when it comes to being a stress case, I find that this is rarely a good idea. You know, I often find that folks who practice natural medicine will hand out hydrocortisone or they'll hand out Isochort or other forms of bioidentical cortisol, and I'm not a big fan of that. I think you have to be really careful about it. If you use it for just a short period and then move on to addressing some of the root causes. Don't stay on it for long. Don't stay on it for more than ideally 8 to 12 weeks.
What about for low cortisol?
Low cortisol, it's interesting. Only a few things are proven. We know that exercise is helpful. African dance has actually been shown to be really helpful. Vitamin C, the vitamin Bs are important. When it comes to herbs, licorice is what's effective. You have to be careful with licorice, though, because it can raise your blood pressure. You got to do that with a clinician who knows what they're doing and they're helping you. Grapefruit juice also has been shown to help you with cortisol. And again, I don't recommend prescriptions when it comes to having low cortisol. I'm not a big fan of using bioidenticals in that situation. I really think it's important to focus on lifestyle, maybe even do some grounding. So this is something I didn't talk about in the book at all. But we've now got this situation where we know when you put your feet on the earth, when you walk on the beach, when you walk in your garden in your bare feet, it really helps you reset your adrenal glands. It helps you reset your cortisol levels. So that's another really good way to do it.
How will I know when my cortisol level is in balance?
Here's how you know. It's funny. It makes me think about that quote about pornography, that you know it when you see it. So when it comes to cortisol, when your level of cortisol is right where you want it to be, you feel buoyant, you feel calm, you feel collected and poised. You bounce out of bed in the morning. I remember seeing a documentary with Wayne Dyer where he gets up in the morning, he puts his feet on the floor, and he says, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." In the mornings when I wake up and I can't do that, I'm thinking coffee, green tea. That's when I know that my cortisol is not in balance and I need to start to channel Wayne Dyer. There's no bags under your eyes. You know, for folks who have these dark circles under their eyes, it is adrenal. It is totally adrenal. You don't have blood sugar swings. You don't have those crazy blood sugar cravings. Your body is in a rhythm with the light dark cycles. The allostatic load is not overwhelming you. You're able to eat nutrient-dense foods and really absorb it. You're not so stressed out that the cortisol is making your gut in trouble. You're able to find this balance in your life between input and output. And when you see sugar, you could take it or leave it. You don't like have all eyes on the sugar, as Britney Spears would say. Yay, fantastic. So I'm so excited that we were able to make it through part two, the second audio about how to assess, diagnose, and treat. This is part of you fast-tracking your hormone cure. So that's it for now. We'll move on to the next hormone next.